climate change alert?
Climate is a serious issue, is probably the defining issue for the 21st century.
There's no easy solution, but this week we'll look at some changes that could help. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. We're all sitting ducks. That's a quote from one of the authors of a new report on climate change released by a UN scientific panel last month. It's a report that may finally be the tipping point, convincing governments that policy changes to address climate change have to be a priority. Or it could be yet another warning that is drowned out by skeptics. Stephanie Kutrix of UN Radio has more on the UN report on climate change.
The effects of climate change that are already occurring on all continents and across the oceans may be severe, pervasive, and irreversible. That's according to a new report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC. The report warns that the world, in many cases, is ill-prepared for risks from a changing climate. It also concludes that there are opportunities to respond to such risks, though the risks will be difficult to manage with high levels of warming. Chris Field is a scientist, researcher, and co-chair of one of the IPCC working groups. Understanding that climate change is a challenge in managing risks opens a wide range of opportunities, he says.
At least for me, I read the report and see reasons for optimism that dealing effectively with climate change can be part of building a world that puts an emphasis on creativity, on innovation, and on proactively solving difficult problems. Climate is a serious issue, is probably the defining issue for the 21st century, but it's also an issue where smart choices can help us make effective contributions toward managing this serious challenge.
Observed impacts of climate change have already affected agriculture, human health, ecosystems on land and in the ocean, water supplies, and some people's livelihoods, the panel notes. Hundreds of scientists and experts, including over 1,000 expert reviewers worldwide, have contributed to the report. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
This week on 51%, we're going to look at answers to the challenge of climate change. There's no single practical answer, but there are a lot of interesting ideas. In a world of dwindling natural resources and mounting environmental crisis, Professor Karen Litvin began a journey to many of the world's eco-villages, intentional communities at the cutting edge of sustainable living. From LA to South India and Denmark to Senegal, rural and urban, high-tech and low-tech, she discovered an under-the-radar global movement making positive and radical changes from the ground up. Martha Baskin reports.
Part travel adventure, part sneak preview of community living arrangements the world over, Ecovillages, a new book by University of Washington professor Karen Litvin, is one to savor and find hope. Litvin, who teaches global environmental politics, was on a mission to find inspiration for herself and her students in the face of failed environmental treaties, unchecked carbon buildup, habitat loss, and species extinction. She found it in micro-level living experiments. With guidance from the Global Ecovillage Network, Litvin's journey took her to 14 communities around the globe, three in the U.S., several in Germany, and others in Australia, Denmark, India, Italy, Japan, Senegal, and the U.K.
And I wanted to study communities in the global north and global south because, after all, about 80% of humanity lives in the not-so-affluent world. But on the other hand, those of us in the global north are living the least sustainably, so we really are in desperate need of the models.
The models ecovillages provide may appear alien to many in the, quote, developed world. Sharing is their taproot, says Litvin, a way of living that makes them a pioneer species. In botany, it's known that whenever land has been devastated through natural or human means, certain tenacious plants are the first species to grow. Ecovillages are like that, she says. They're showing a way forward with ecological awareness, interdependence, and tenacity. Unlike the back-to-the-land movements of the 60s and 70s, ecovillages aren't interested in being separate from the world, but in demonstrating what Litvin calls low-energy cosmopolitanism.
And that's basically, how do you have a planetary identity and planetary consciousness, even a planetary civilization, and do so with as little energy as possible?
We don't all need to go out and build new eco-villages, says Litvin. Instead, we need to glean their lessons and apply them wherever we live in order to lower our own carbon footprint. The average American is responsible for 19.8 tons of carbon per person, while the average Chinese citizen clocks in at 4.6 tons, and those in India a mere 1.2 tons per person. One eco-village that attracts the most attention is Damanhur in the Italian Alps. Spiritual yet high-tech, it boasts a molecular biology lab for testing genetically modified food, a smartphone for every member, and an address that's listed as the eighth wonder of the world. Gaia theory, the idea that Earth is a living, sentient being, is taken a few steps further at Damanhur, says Litvin.
And they believe that their community in the foothills of the Alps is actually tapping into the nervous system of Gaia.
25 nucleos, or communities, are devoted to a particular kind of work. Everything from animal husbandry and international relations to learning how to communicate with plants.
I stayed in the community that was trying to learn from plants and communicate with the plants. And they live in tree houses, arborically.
Litvin says she did the same. Another eco-village, Oroville, in South India's Tamil Nadu state, is one of the few places on Earth where biodiversity is increasing. Called the City of Dawn, the 2,000-member community has people from 43 different countries who live smack in the middle of 40,000 Tamil villages. One of the first things the community did when it was begun in 1968 was to plant trees, 3 million of them. A forest was restored.
And as a consequence, the birds come back and the insects come back. And this is on a desertified plateau where there was no firewood. There was really nothing for the villagers. And it was a pretty desperate place to live.
Ecological practices at Oroville have repercussions around the world. They were at the forefront of modern earth building using compressed earth, mud brick, cob, loam, and other techniques. Oroville was also ahead of its time with windmills capable of pumping water in a renewable way, solar power water heaters and lighting, and biogas for cooking. After a year spent visiting 14 thriving eco-villages, Litvin, a political theorist on top of her work as a professor of global environmental studies, devised a new theory for these low-carbon living labs. E2C2. Ecology, economics, community, and consciousness, or four windows in the house of sustainability. The question for all of us in an age of climate change and ecosystem disruption is, how do we live in our own house? Our actions, says Litvin, are unintentionally unraveling the planet's life support system.
But it also means that what we do makes a difference. And you could say it's lighting a fire under us to actually make some real changes.
Just back from a 2-month book launch, Litvin is once again in the classroom sharing her journey and lighting fires of understanding. Green Acre Radio is brought to you with support from the Human Links Foundation, engineering by C.J. Lazenby. From the studios of Jackstraw Productions, this is Martha Baskin.
Access to power sources has been identified by the UN as a way to boost sustainable development. But the fact is that millions of people around the world still live without access to electricity, and generating that power can result in environmental problems. In rural India, one couple has found an innovative solution to the problem right under their feet, showing that small-scale solutions can help solve big problems.
The lush green slopes of northern India are covered in dense forest. It was this stunning beauty that attracted Rajneesh and Rashmi Jain here 20 years ago, as Rashmi explains.
Initially, the idea was that both of us wanted to change our own lifestyle, to change living in the city and come to an area which was rural.
They decided to take a bold step and follow their dream. Amidst the forest, they built Avani, a small village far from any modern conveniences, including electricity. And because, like so many rural villages in India, it was off the grid, they installed solar panels for lighting. It seemed idyllic, but not for long. Every year, rampant fires swept through the forest, threatening their village and their lives. During the dry season, the thousands of tons of needles from the pine trees, which blanketed the forest floor, became a tinderbox. But one day, Rajneesh questioned whether the pine needles might actually be useful for something.
There is a potential there. There is energy there. Can we harness that energy? And that's what sent us in the direction of generating some kind of usable energy from pine needles.
They asked villagers to collect the pine needles before they caught fire and bring them to Rajneesh. At first, everyone thought they were crazy.
These guys are paying us for collecting pine needles, so they must have lost their nuts and bolts somewhere, you know. And literally it was like that. They were laughing at me.
But Rajneesh and Rashmi had seen a potential in the pine needles, which they believed would not only protect the environment, but despite skepticism, also change the villagers' lives. The resin inside each pine needle is a source of fuel that, when heated, produces gas that powers a generator. 100 kilowatts of clean, renewable electricity now flow to Avani's 20 residences as well as its businesses.
It was so simple. It was amazing for me to see my first power plant started generating power. I was almost on the verge of crying. It was really a magical moment for me.
Olav Kjørven of the United Nations Development Programme recognizes the value of these small-scale innovations which address many local issues.
The project with the pine needles is fascinating. It's not only about a hazard related to forest fires, it's about giving income to people that are now collecting these needles in order to produce the energy.
It's also about how access to electricity helps increase earnings. Avani has always made fine silk products. But now, with power for lights and heavy machinery, they've been able to increase output significantly, providing living wages for 15 people.
When there is more reliable access to electricity in these remote areas, it will drive the rural economy. Across the world, there are a lot of people who are living in darkness. They could use something.
We feel it can be done anywhere and everywhere.
Although 85% of rural India still has no access to modern energy, small-scale systems like Avani's pine needle gasifier are changing the landscape and are proof that simple solutions can help solve big problems.
Coming up, fishing for a living in a changing sea, and re-examining higher education. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1291. For decades, fishery management has focused almost exclusively on the need to restrict fishing. But as Heather Goldstone reports, environmental changes are forcing both fishermen and regulators to reevaluate their traditional practices.
This is the sound of climate change. That's an Atlantic croaker making the noise for which it's named. Croaker is the target of a lucrative fishery extending from Florida to New Jersey. But some say it's the future of New England's fisheries. Last year, Ernie Eldridge pulled up a glimpse of that future in his weir nets off Chatham.
We had one croaker. We had one, I believe it was a gray triggerfish also.
Weir fishing on Cape Cod is a tradition that stretches back hundreds, if not thousands, of years. The circular nets anchored by hickory poles are like underwater corrals that trap fish as they migrate along the coast. Eldridge says he's witnessed a major shift in recent years.
Right through the whole food chain, everything seems to be changing. It's traditional travel patterns.
The odd southern fish is part of it, But the bigger problem is that Eldridge's traditional targets have moved offshore out of reach of his nets. This weir is empty, and he's already disassembling his others 2 months earlier than usual. He says climate change is to blame.
For all practical purposes, there's no reason, other reason. You know, these fish have been traveling the same areas for who knows how long.
Rising carbon dioxide levels have profound consequences for ocean ecosystems. Water temperatures increase, ocean chemistry changes, and weather patterns shift. The microscopic plants and animals at the base of the food chain respond, and the impacts reverberate through the ecosystem. The location, growth, reproduction, even behavior of fish is affected. Northeast Fisheries Science Center Chief Oceanographer Dr. John Hare says coping with climate change will take a major shift in fishery science and management.
The take-home message is that a lot of things are changing, and the way that we tend to think about ecosystems is that they're static and non-changing. And so we're now confronted with how do we move forward with our traditional assumption that things don't change when we now have evidence, data, that tells us that many aspects of the ecosystem are changing.
Hare is one of many who say the key to weathering climate change is something called ecosystem-based management. As the name implies, the idea is to base any one decision on a comprehensive understanding of the entire ecosystem. It's a logical idea, but far from simple.
I think conceptually, it conveys a benefit, but the devil is in the details and in how it's implemented.
The first step is getting a handle on the physical and chemical changes taking place in the ocean. Hare and his colleagues have documented deviations in temperature, salinity, acidity, and nutrient levels in New England's waters. They're also seeing shifts in wind patterns and ocean currents in the Gulf of Maine. And that translates into ecological changes.
Community composition of the phytoplankton, the small microscopic plants in the sea, is changing. Community composition of the zooplankton, the small animals, little tiny crabs that eat the tiny little plants, is changing. So we're starting to sort of track these changes from the physics into the lower trophic levels, the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, and trying to track it up into fish populations or marine mammal populations.
Scientists now think that altered zooplankton populations may be one reason cod stocks haven't rebounded as quickly as expected. In addition, water temperatures in southern New England are getting uncomfortably warm for cod, so they're moving northward and offshore in search of cooler water. And they're not alone. Over the past 50 years, more than half of all commercially exploited species have responded to warming waters by changing where they live, like the fish that used to fill Eldridge's weir.
In the height of the season, and it'd be nothing for us to go out and fill three boats up and come home. And a lot of days we'd fill three boats up and go back out and fill a couple more up. And that's just gone now.
While the impacts of climate change are increasingly apparent, that information currently doesn't get factored into management decisions. The changing environment isn't even part of the computer models used to simulate fish populations and set catch limits. The problem is, even if climate change were built into fishery assessments, no one is quite sure what to do about it. Peter Baker directs the Northeast Fisheries Program for Pew Environment Group. He says one important step is blocking off areas of the ocean where fishing is prohibited so ecosystems can adapt to climate change.
If we can protect those fish where they need to be to rebuild from fishing, they can have the resiliency to withstand other pressures like climate change.
But federal regulators are actually considering reopening a number of historically closed areas in New England. Instead, they've opted for management schemes that set explicit catch allowances for each species. Ecosystem models could be used to match those limits to the fluctuations in fish populations resulting from climate change. But Mike Conathan, who's director of ocean policy at the Center for American Progress, says there's a lot more to this than just catch limits.
As fish stocks migrate and as fish move north into colder water primarily, they're moving into areas where the industry is not necessarily set up with the proper gear to catch the species that are moving into their waters, and they also may not have permits to catch those fish.
Take Eldridge's croaker, for example. Croaker is a nearshore species that's regulated at the state level. In Maryland, that fish would have been subject to size limits and gear specifications. But here in Massachusetts?
As far as I know, there's no regulation up here on croakers.
That's just one example of the regulatory complexities that arise from climate change. Conathan argues that in response, we need a whole new paradigm for fishery management, one that favors flexibility and diversity over history and geography.
And it's something that legislators and managers are going to have to deal with because there's no question that the changes are happening. You know, we've seen the literature on that, you know, and fishermen have seen what they're pulling up in their net.
Eldridge says he counts himself lucky to be a weir fisherman. There are fewer regulations and no long trips offshore. But weirs are the most fixed of fishing gear. They can't just pick up and move to follow the fish. As he drives away from his weir, Eldridge says he'll spend this winter mulling a difficult decision about whether or not to continue. For the Cape and Islands NPR stations, I'm Heather Goldstone.
This story was produced as part of the Living Lab radio project. Solving future problems requires an educated population, but access to education is becoming financially out of reach, even as it becomes easier to access. In May of 2012, Harvard and MIT announced a partnership to provide free courses to anyone, anywhere, sparking an intense debate about the future of a bricks-and-mortar education. Sarah McConnell has this interview from the Open and Digital Learning Resources Conference.
Colleen Taylor teaches chemistry at Virginia State University and at John Tyler Community College. She's tried lots of creative ways to teach a difficult subject. Now she's using the so-called flipped classroom approach. It's also called the inverted classroom, and getting very good results. She records her lectures for the students to view from home and uses class time for working on difficult problems.
I had an online class, which ended up having Virginia State University students in it who were on campus, which seemed kind of silly to be taking a distance class when you're on campus. And it actually worked pretty well. I said, well, we'll just hold these recitation sections and you'll have their lectures online. And their performance was absolutely wonderful. And I said, well, this is really nice. And what was the most interesting thing was the relationship that I had with these students was much better, much less professor and students, and it was much more a guide. And so I began doing this flipped or inverted classroom where the students watch lectures outside, and we do worksheets and group work in class. And that's the way I've been teaching for 4 years now. It's been very successful. There's a group of students in our classrooms that needs that extra boost, that extra, how do I go about studying? And you cannot do that in your traditional lecture mode.
So devil's advocate, what about naysayers who say we're just sending too many people to college? If they're not motivated, they don't want to do the work, they shouldn't be there.
Well, I wouldn't want to live in that society where we only allowed students who were overachievers to get a college education. And I think if you're only allowing a certain student into that, it wouldn't have been me, because I certainly wasn't an overachiever in high school. And even though I waited longer, I was desperately thankful for the community college I started out in, who helped me re-enter college. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have that opportunity. I wasn't one of those students. I wasn't one of the elite. From my background, I can tell you there's a lot of potential out there. And if we can't bring some of those students into the fold, we're just not worthwhile as a society.
I feel very lucky we have you.
Thank you.
Colleen Taylor teaches chemistry at Virginia State University and at John Tyler Community College.
That interview comes to us courtesy of withgoodreasonradio.org. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.